A couple of months ago, we started a new liturgical year based on the reading of Luke's Gospel. And today, all of a sudden, we're reading from John. John's Gospel doesn't have its own year in the lectionary, and so readings from John are inserted every now and then in the years that belong to the other Gospels, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now, at this time in the liturgical year, we're reading stories from the Gospels about the beginning of Jesus' ministry. We're in the season of Epiphany. We hear stories about the baptism of Jesus, as we did last week. We hear stories about the recruitment of disciples, the inaugural sermon, which we're going to hear next week, and other events that take place early on. Now, in John's Gospel, after being baptized and calling some disciples, the first report of ministry is the account that we read today, the well-known story about the wedding at which Jesus is said to have turned water into wine. And my job in the sermon is to lead you in a reflection about the meaning of this story and its relevance for our lives and ministry today. Well, there are some basic elements in the story that may be helpful in understanding its role in our faith tradition. Let's look at a few of these. The story begins with the phrase, "on the third day." In John's account, Jesus spends the first 2 days of his ministry after his baptism calling disciples. Then on the third day, they go to Cana to the wedding. But the use of the phrase, "the third day," may carry extra significance in a gospel that is loaded with symbols and metaphors. Jesus was raised on the third day, so something extraordinary is bound to happen on the third day. And indeed, in our story, something extraordinary does happen. When the wine runs out at the wedding reception, nearly 200 gallons of very good wine magically appear. That would be the equivalent of at least 1,750 milliliter bottles. I'm keeping track, you see. The guests had already had plenty to drink. Nevertheless, a great abundance of the best wine is now made available to them. And according to the story, Jesus arranged for that to happen in a magical sort of way. For now, let's just remember that this happened on a third day, thereby putting this event in the same category as the resurrection. There are other bits of language that connect this event with the ultimate destiny of Jesus. The story says that what Jesus did at Cana revealed his glory. Now, the revelation of the glory of Jesus is a major theme in John's Gospel. The work that Jesus does reveals his glory, and his work is finished in the crucifixion. Jesus even says on the cross in John's Gospel, "it is finished," referring to his work. And the crucifixion is said to be, in John, the ultimate glorification of Jesus. Now, it's interesting that Jesus seems reluctant to get the glorification process going in our story today. According to the story, it was his mother who wanted Jesus to do something about the lack of wine. When the wine gave out, she said to Jesus, "they have no wine. Do something." And Jesus said, "what has that got to do with us? My hour has not yet come," which refers to the hour of his glorification, the hour of his crucifixion and ultimate vindication. And although Jesus may be reluctant, John, the gospel writer, is eager to spin out the glory. He wants it demonstrated in the very first act of ministry. Now, by the way, it's significant that in spite of the gospel writer's determination to provide proof for the special status of Jesus, the reluctance of Jesus to claim special status is nevertheless preserved in the gospel record, not just in John's gospel. In several stories throughout the gospels, Jesus is reluctant to be named the Messiah. Sometimes he doesn't want to take credit for healings. In today's story, he doesn't really want to perform a miracle. And it has to make us wonder, who is the real Jesus behind these stories? What was his agenda anyway? Was it to prove himself the Messiah or Son of God? Or did he have something else in mind? Well, next Sunday we'll get a chance to look at the agenda that Jesus had in mind when we look at his inaugural sermon. But today, let's look a little bit further into the magic as reported by the Gospel of John. The Gospel writers do have something to prove. And John, in particular, is blatant in his agenda. Right from the beginning, John wants his readers to know, to understand, to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. This is stated over and over again in John's Gospel. And at the end of the Gospel, John explicitly states that the Gospel has been written so that you may come to believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And the method that John uses in presenting his case is to present his readers with a series of what he calls signs. Signs that show something about Jesus being the Son of God. The fuller version of the verse that I've just quoted says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of disciples, which are not written in the book, but these are written so that you may come to believe," and so on. Turning water into wine, then, was the first of these signs. It actually says so in our gospel reading today. Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Now, I may be naive, but I would guess that virtually no one can believe that water can really be turned into wine just by pouring it into some ceremonial jars. That is literally fantastic. And therefore, to base an argument for the divinity of Jesus on such fantasy obviously puts the divinity of Jesus in the realm of fantasy as well. A better option is to recognize these stories for what they are. Devices to grab our attention in order to get us thinking about the essential message of the words and work of Jesus. And from this point of view, we simply cannot take the gospel stories literally. Jesus can no sooner be literally the Son of God as he could have actually turned the water into wine. It would appear that the gospel writers had to portray Jesus as a really miraculous guy if they were going to get anyone to pay attention, let alone to believe. Now, true belief in the gospel is actually just as challenging, perhaps a whole lot more challenging, than believing in the magic turning of water into wine. And our story today is trying to tell us something like that. You want to believe in this person called Jesus? Well, that's going to be a very tough assignment. Try this story on for size. One day, Jesus turned water into wine. Don't believe it? Too bad for you. The water into wine shtick is a piece of cake compared to what this story is really all about. It's just something to point you in a certain direction. It's just a sign. Yes, a sign of the incredible yet profoundly authentic message brought to us by this person, Jesus, a.k.a. the Messiah, the Son of God, and so on. So what is the message of the gospel, this incredible yet authentic, this life-affirming good news? Well, the ultimate sign of the message, according to John's gospel, is the crucifixion. And at first glance, that is all about suffering and death. But at a more profound level, the work of Jesus on the cross speaks to us about the noblest expressions of virtue and integrity. Jesus exercised his ministry with a profound sense of justice and compassion. Let's say a divine sense of justice and compassion. The powers that be were not amused, and so Jesus was tortured and killed. But that divine sense of justice and compassion was not diminished or extinguished in the suffering and death of Jesus. Though the wine of his mortal existence gave out, 1,000 bottles of the best wine yet burst onto the scene. God so loved the world, says John the Gospel writer. Ultimately, the incredible yet authentic message of the gospel is that in the face of the worst the world has to offer, God's best is yet to come. These days we are seeing a lot of the worst. In the face of a devastating earthquake, the poorest nation in our hemisphere literally crumbles. Hundreds of thousands are injured or dead. Here in Canada, our governments are letting us down. Kairos has had essential funding taken away. Our national parliament is prorogued once again. Services for Aboriginal people and others on the fringes are inadequate, to say the least. On the global scene, we are profoundly disappointed with the results of the climate change meetings at Copenhagen. And of course, we have challenges in our personal lives as well. Add it all up, and our lives can be rather overwhelming, if not downright depressing. In the face of all of this, the gospel maintains that the best is yet to come. And that best has everything to do with our ability, our capacity, our opportunity as followers of Jesus to embrace the legacy of justice and compassion left to us by Jesus in the aftermath of his ministry and crucifixion. This legacy is the abundance of fine wine available to those who believe that greed and corruption cannot wipe out justice, that chaos and violence cannot kill compassion, that procrastination cannot undermine goodwill, and that self-serving bureaucracy cannot stop us from living with respect in creation. Now, we have plenty of opportunities to live out this faith in our everyday lives, in the life of our congregation, in the life of our national church. And in the life of our United Church, there are two initiatives that I'd like to draw to your attention. One is an invitation from Nora Sanders, General Secretary of the General Council, inviting the church to provide input and suggestions for planning the work of the United Church in the next triennium. Where is our United Church going? Are we fading out of the picture, or is the best yet to come? We're going to have a congregational forum to discuss this a few weeks from now, February the 7th, after worship. In the meantime, I've posted a couple of relevant documents on our church website that everyone can read in preparation for our forum. Now, the second initiative is an open letter to all Canadians from Marty Tyndall, our moderator. The letter is being made public today. It'll also appear as a link on our website. Of course, it'll be posted on the United Church website. We've got a few hard copies of it on one of the tables in the narthex today as well. And we're going to hear some excerpts from it at this time also. And so to finish this sermon time, I'm going to invite Paul Stott to read some of the excerpts from Marty's letter.
Thank you, Hans. As we are worshiping here, our moderator, Marty Tyndall, is worshiping in her home congregation in Brantford, and as part of that service, she is reading this letter that we're going to hear excerpts from now. Where is the hope after Copenhagen? An open letter to all Canadians from the moderator of the United Church of Canada. This letter was born in Copenhagen, where, broken-hearted, I watched the international climate talks fall apart. Heartbroken because it was clear to me, as it was to many of you, that the talks in Copenhagen needed to succeed, that it is no longer safe for us to go on as we have before. I believe this is a unique time in humanity's fretful reign on Earth, a rare moment that will have historic significance. And yet the Copenhagen talks failed. We have no plan to reduce deadly emissions of carbon dioxide, emissions that are a symptom of our broken relationship with the web of life, emissions that are rising faster than at any time in human history. We also have no legally binding agreement. Instead, we have feeble words clothed in mistrust, the phantom of a deal. One moment of opportunity came and then went, and here we are now, the fate of civilization and of millions of the planet's life forms hanging by the frayed thread of inaction. So where is our hope? I believe the answer to this question is that hope is in you. It is in me and in all of us who choose to reject despair and embrace hope. Together we will replace the Copenhagen failure with success. It is up to us. Marty goes on in her letter to explain how she was inspired by Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, and explains why the demands of a moral crisis call not only Christians, but all concerned citizens to action. She also calls on us to remember the courageous actions of Nellie McClung and William Wilberforce, Christians who called their societies to address social evils. She argues that the climate change issue facing us today is a similar issue that must be addressed. She closes her letter by saying, "So what am I asking you to do? Whatever it takes to follow in the footsteps of inspirational leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. Whatever you can imagine, I wouldn't dream of limiting you to my list. The possibilities are abundant. In our homes and offices, in our places of worship, in our families and community organizations, as individuals acting together, let us choose hope and action over despair and paralysis. Every day I receive new messages from people who are making dramatic changes in their lives. The answers are already here. Together, let us act by our beliefs. When we do this, we will replace the fearful self-interest of Copenhagen with joyful inclusion and healing of the world. This is a transformational moment in the planet's history. The world will be shaped by how we and our communities respond in the months to come. It will take all of us, all of you. I can see your imagination spinning forth even now, making this safe, healthy new world come to life. A new world where broken hearts are transformed as we take heart together. With sincerity and hope, Marty Tyndall, moderator, the United Church of Canada."